Now, I was told last night that today we are reading Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 6, Chapter 5, Narada Muni cursed by Prajapati Daksha, verses 27 and 28. Do we have the verse, anything written down, or we just carry on? 29. Iti tan api rajendra praja sarga diyo muni upechya narada praha vachakutani purvavat. Translation. O King Parikshit, Narada Muni approached these sons of Prajapati Daksha, who were engaged in tapasya to begin children, and spoke enigmatic words to them, just as he had spoken to their elder brothers. Kutani, I see. Okay. Prabhupada translates Kutani as enigmatic. Kutani also. Well, enigmatic sort of means somewhat diplomatic, even duplicitous, something like that, like cheating a little bit could be. Enigmatic, so, you know, means you could take it one way or another. Dakshayana samshunuta gadato nigama mama anvichatanupada bhim brachinam brachrivatsala. O sons of Daksha, please hear my words of instruction attentively. You are all very affectionate to your elder brothers, the Haryashvans. Therefore, you should follow their path. So on one hand, it appears like he is encouraging family attachment. Bratri Vatsala. O you who are very affectionate to your brothers, you should follow their path. Well, you already know the story. They had given up their aspirations of family life and reproduction and had taken to the spiritual path wholeheartedly. No looking back. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Narada Muni encouraged Prajapati Daksha's second group of sons by awakening their natural affinity for their brothers. He urged them to follow their older brothers if they were at all affectionate toward them. Family affection is very strong, and therefore Narada Muni followed this tactic of reminding them of their family relationship with the Haryashvans. Generally, the word nigama refers to the Vedas, but here nigama refers to the instructions contained in the Vedas. Srimad Bhagavatam says, nigama kalpaturo galitam palam. The Vedic instructions are like a tree of which Srimad Bhagavatam is the ripened fruit. Narad Muni is engaged in distributing this fruit, and therefore he instructed Vyasadeva to write this Mahapurana, Srimad Bhagavatam, for the benefit of ignorant human society. Anarto Pashavam Sakshad Bhakti Yogam Adhoksha Jain Lokasya Janato Vidvans Chakre Satvata Samhitam. The material miseries of the living entity, which is superfluous to him, can be directly mitigated by the linking process of devotional service. But the mass of people do not know this, and therefore the learned Vyasadeva compiled this Vedic literature, which is in relation to the supreme truth. Srimad Bhagavatam 1.7.6. People are suffering because of ignorance and are following a wrong path for happiness. This is called anatta. These material activities will never make them happy. And therefore, Narada instructed Vyasadeva to record the instructions of Srimad Bhagavatam. Vyasadeva actually followed Narada and did this. Srimad Bhagavatam is the supreme instruction of the Vedas. Gavitam phala, the ripened fruit of the Vedas, is Srimad Bhagavatam. Dakshayana san srinuta gadato nigamam nama anvichatam padavim vrachinam vrachri vatsala. O sons of Daksha, please hear my words of instruction attentively. You're all very affectionate to your elder brothers, the Hariyashvans. Therefore, you should follow their path. Om Gyanatvarana Sevyanam Zarashanakhe Chakshamilatamiyanatasma Shri Guru Vedma Shri Jitani Mano Vishnam Stavitam Yena Hudale Swayam Rupi Gadamayam Tadati Sarvandika Anshikapaturibhiyas Jagripas Indubhiyanacha Patitanam Dhamanibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sri Vasti Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. See this. Narada Muni is an expert preacher. And he knows that in order to effectively present Krishna consciousness to people in such ways that they will accept it and apply it and become devotees, that you have to do that scientifically. You have to do that carefully, and here even Srila Prabhupada uses the word tactic. Yes, it is not a matter of just pressing people, browbeating people, but one has to be very sensitive and careful and very personal in how one presents Krishna consciousness. If one wants to get a nice result from the preaching, and if one wants to actually help the people in real ways. I was one time in Northern Ireland, and we were distributing books in a town named Coleraine, famous place for book distribution. That was, well, I forget exactly, but it may have been 77 or 8, quite a few years ago. That day, I still remember, between four of us, we distributed several hundred books. Very nice. So, it was a Christmas marathon. So, anyway, there we were, doing our thing, in the walking street there. And one Christian preacher came, with all due respect to the Christian preachers, but anyway, in this case, this gentleman, he did not have that type of approach. But his approach was very much a sort of straight in the face and even brutal approach, sort of. He was standing at the side of the road with his Bible, with a loud, some sort of little amplification system, screaming at the people that they're all going to hell and things like this. This was the basic mode of presentation. And just telling them they're all sinful dogs. And he was working them over completely. And the people were not appreciating. In fact, at one point, he was standing with his Bible, holding his Bible up, microphone, and screaming up, so on and so forth. Then he was saying about how glorious the Bible is, how much it helps, and we must base our lives on it. He threw it on the floor, on the road, and stood on it with both feet. Somehow managed to stand on the bull. He said, "I stand on the Bible." No, he meant a certain thing. My life is based on the Bible, but it was not attractive to any, I would have thought, any sensitive person or thoughtful person. Maybe to those who are kind of more of the flock mentality type, or, I don't know, who just like to be taken charge of. Yeah, they might have responded nicely, but we were, you know, we were interacting with the people, and so many of them told us that, "Wow, this is terrible," and they were Christians. You know, they're kind of staunch Protestants up there. And even some of them who we were not stopping, they were just walking by. We could hear them talking to each other and making comments. Yeah. So Narayana, he did not do that with the Haryashvas. This group is called the, what is it? Shalyashvas. Sabalashvas. Sabalashvas. Yeah, not like that. That doesn't mean he's simply being diplomatic for the sake of it and being political and just saying something for the sake of saying something. But actually, there's no substance to it. It's not difficult to market things if you talk the language of the market, of the people in the market. But if you're presenting something which is, the marketplace is really not perhaps going to accept so much just like that, then it has to be done in very thoughtful ways. In fact, Srila Prabhupada made the point, he said, it is as if I have opened a shop on the main street of every city. And in that shop, I am offering nothing that the people want. But I'm telling them when they walk in, I'm telling them, just come in. Just give up everything. Give all your money. Give your life. We will give you nothing of that sort, materially. So if you have such a shop, what would you expect the result to be? You would not do a lot of business. But even so, still in that sense, That's what we are offering. No, well, it was there in the third point yesterday. I was under the impression we were reading the previous verse, so I faithfully read it and thought about it. But it's somewhat different. Not so much in a sense. But Prabhupada's saying there that we have to accept austerity. You cannot just carry on with your life of extreme sense gratification, particularly just really pushing for sense gratification, really trying to expand that and going into all sorts of variations on that theme of illicit sex, particularly intoxication. You know, the materialists, they explore these realms just like some, whenever it was, a couple of hundred years ago or so, people were going around exploring the world, so-called discovering South Africa, America, Australia, New Zealand, all these places, discovering. Oh, of course, there were already people living there, but you know, that doesn't count. And, you know, going to the South Pole, the North Pole, even dying on the way, or risking their lives at least. So they are exploring sense gratification. You know, the field of intoxication previously, when I was young at least, it was just liquor. But then different drugs, different chemical things started coming in. And then they became extremely popular. And even now, since that time, the whole field has developed further. Has really developed a lot, it seems. When I was young, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones were considered way out. Avant-garde, really. Extreme. Then some years ago, maybe 10 years ago or so, or a little more, some of our devotees in America, who at the time were a leading punk rock straight edge group, they asked me, would you like to see a video of us singing? I said, sure, why not? They said, it's pretty heavy, I don't know if you like it. I didn't say anything, I just thought, oh, come on. I saw the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin and all these people. It's not a big deal for me. But then I saw that. Wow. It was bizarre. Walking over the top of the audience. And various things. So they're exploring. They're going into all these fields and expanding them. I was in Mayapur, first time I went to India in 1976 for the festival, and Srila Prabhupada was giving class. And Srila Prabhupada made the point, and struck me very deeply at the time, that the animals... Could we just close the door a bit for a moment? The animals, their sense gratification, it's very simple. They just do the same things in the same ways. And in this way, in these ways, they try to enjoy life in the material world. Their eating habits, they just eat the same things. The cows and the sheep, they just eat the grass. And they don't ask, is it Kukuyu? Or is it, well, I don't know any other brands. But is it something else? What age is it? What spicing did you use? Is it baked or deep fried? It's just the same grass. They never ask for anything else. And they literally, practically eat all day. Human beings, oh. Now, it used to be very localized. Even still in India, it's like that to some degree outside of the cities. You can only get what they grow in that vicinity. So when it's this season, you get that. When it's not, you don't. But now, even in India, in the cities, there are shops. You can get any food just like here or almost like Europe or America. Any food from anywhere in the world. Imported foods. You can get. But the cows are just eating grass every day. So they are not. Prabhupada was making this point. That the animals, of course, they are simply eating, sleeping, mating and defending. And this is not good. This is not good. And the humans are doing the same things. But just see, the humans are expanding those fields. And in the course of that, becoming implicated in more sinful reaction. You know, particularly things like illicit sex life, developing that field, and, you know, now same sex I read yesterday somewhere. Oh, it was in the In-Flight magazine I briefly glanced at, that South Africa is one of only 5 countries which has okayed same-sex marriages. Should we applaud or what? But, you know, generally, the animals don't really get into these things. You know, it's a pretty simple and basic approach. But in human society, then you get all these things going on. We're not going to go into the details, but you know, it's by the day becoming more diverse. Yeah. So we have to present Krishna consciousness to people like this. And there were times in the past when devotees distributing books would do, you know, some questionable things. Like, I remember one devotee was distributing books during one marathon, and he told the person, it was a volume of Srimad Bhagavatam, because they used to distribute, you know, whenever a new canto would come out, they would just take it on the street and just distribute it on the street. So, you know, maybe even the 6th canto. And the fellow, the potential customer, looking at this book, 6th canto, Srimad Bhagavatam, there's Chitraketu and Lord Vishnu on the back, the Yamadutas. He said, look, you know, I'm not really into these things. I'm into sport. I play golf. And the devotee, maybe not so totally blatantly, but basically said, you take this book, it will help you with your golf. And the story became quite famous because the man then contacted the temple afterwards, and, you know, he was upset. Yeah. It became a bit of an issue. So marketing, we're just mentioning marketing. That the thing is though, We don't want to just promise them just sense gratification like material life. They should have some idea that this is something higher. This is something for higher consciousness and a more advanced type of life. But still, we have to present that very nicely and attractively. So, Srila Prabhupada, the whole question about distributing books and lying, telling lies to people, just to get them to take the book and hand over the money. And even, you know, I had experience of devotees coming running over and saying, we've got to get out of here. I just sold the book to him and I told him, you know, X, Y, Z. And then he sat down and started looking at the book. Normally they take it home before they start reading. So we've got to get out of here before. So this is not really the right approach. No, they handle the book. Prabhupada said, even if they touch the book, they're benefiting. So, okay, that's there. It is true. Prabhupada said, if they just read one word, their lives may change. That's there. It's true. It's a fact. But at the same time, well, we even experienced in America particularly, they had a particular tactic which they adopted for selling more books and for getting more money. And it worked very well. The tactic was called the change-up. Give the person the book. Ask them to give a donation. They pull out some note. And you tell them, look, you know, I happen to have a lot of big notes. No. Do you have any big notes? I'll give you change. So the man, you know, you expect or you hope for, let us say, $10. He gives you a 50. You give him $5 back and say, is that okay? This is called the change up. And then, you know, the person was not expecting to give $45. He says, well, no. So then you give him another $1. Is that okay? And then you just sort of keep on like this, a dollar at a time. Eventually the person will just give up. Seriously, this is the changer. And the thing is, you know, they got a lot of books out. They got a lot of money. They got a lot of Lakshmi. And they were feeling very good about it. But the problem is, when it comes to strategies and tactics and, you know, all this kind of, we're going into a very sensitive area. If you're not advanced enough, then you, with your neophyte consciousness, you may think up a strategy which, you know, may half work, but the other half, it doesn't work, it may backfire. And this is what happened. So the devotees eventually, they had to stop distributing in the airports because there were so many complaints. And so, yeah, it was just getting too much. So the book distribution collapsed. And they attributed it largely to the use of that change-up and the people becoming so resistant. So many people, they already got a book, they already got changed up. Because they were distributing a lot of books. Really, really a lot of books. So they were meeting, you know, potential repeat customers on a daily basis, like every few minutes. They would meet someone who already got a book. Every day they'd meet dozens. And the response almost universally was, get out of here. I got one of your books and a heavy reaction. But we see when we've been distributing lots of books and where the devotees have really been doing it very nicely and dealing with the people very nicely and so on like this with a view more to the future, that the people who already took a book, they will take another book. I hear so many stories about this. And even they come and want all the books. And, you know, one devotee in those days of the change-up, he was used to people coming back and demanding their money back. And one day, this one lady came running up and said, "Are you selling these books?" She had it with her from some previous time. And he thought, he hadn't distributed one book. That day. And he thought, I'm going to have to take the book back and give her the money back. And I haven't distributed any books yet. I'm going to start off the day with minus one book. And she said, so he was ready for it, bracing himself for an apology. And then she said, "This book is amazing. I want more." And he couldn't believe it. Of course, it's always very nice if something like that happens. But this was like, what? He'd never met anyone like that. So anyway, the thing is here, now that he's preaching, it's the same idea as distributing books. The principle is essentially the same. We're trying to influence people. As Dale Carnegie said, how to win friends and influence people. So we're trying to influence people. And there are different ways you can do that. But Narada Muni, he is doing it in a very compassionate way, in a very thoughtful way, in a very considerate way. But this does not mean that he is just being a softy. And as soon as the person raises some objection, he goes, "Oh, I don't want to bother persons. So I won't, you know, won't get into a debate or something like that." No, he was, as Prabhupada says, using tactics and strategies how to get the message across, but get the actual message across. And so Srila Prabhupada said, "Just see, we are spreading this movement, and just see, even though we're telling people, as we mentioned in the beginning, that come in here, give us all your money, we'll give you nothing, but then do it. At least those who are becoming devotees. And they're giving their lives, and we don't pay them anything." Here, you're looking at a man who's been working for the company. On the 7th of January, it will be 35 years to the day. And I have not been paid one penny. Yet. So, you know, either one has to be too stupid, or there has to be something much deeper in it, which is the case. And Srila Prabhupada was making this point. Where on the high street of any city do you find a shop like that? But Prabhupada said, "I started a shop like that in New York. And before I knew, so many of them were coming, we didn't have a place to put them." Yeah. So this is preaching. Preaching is not for just, you know, like a parent program. Of course, also, we have to repeat. There's an interesting story in that regard. One devotee, once in Bombay, was asked to give class. So what he did, he was thinking, you know, Prabhupada. Prabhupada is the greatest, which is true. Whatever Prabhupada says is the best, which is also true. Prabhupada's words are the best. It's also true. So he thought, I will just read. I will not give the class and, you know, express anything myself. I'll just read, because it's all Prabhupada. So he did that. And some of the people complained to Srila Prabhupada that he didn't give class. He just read. And so Prabhupada spoke to him about it. And he was a little bewildered. He said, but Prabhupada, I just read your words. And Srila Prabhupada said, no, they want to hear your realization. And there's special nectar in these things. So you present the message in your own way. So that we have to do. Not just when someone comes to us with a question. You know, we have our computer there at least. We can quickly type in the catchwords, you know, about the question. What about this? So you type in that, and you come up with 150 quotes from Prabhupada's books, and you just read a few to him. No, you should present it nicely, and try to understand the person, where they're coming from, what there is in Krishna consciousness that this person will find attractive. But some other person might not find attractive. You know, there's the famous story I've told it all over the world. It's from Cape Town. It is from Table View, Pick and Pay. The smaller one across from the big center, if you know what I mean. You know, Mother Rati Manjari was there years ago. Maybe 10 years ago, we went to visit her in the early afternoon or sometime late morning perhaps. So there we were, and she came and said, you know, I had an amazing experience. I met this heavy metal boy. Yeah, I told the story all over the world, everyone likes it. I met this heavy metal boy. He was in black. And, you know, long, sort of greasy hair, really looked the part. And some t-shirt with some, you know, heavy, gruesome statement like skull and crossbones, I love Satan. This is the January. He was a classic. And she handed him a book. Oh, well, no. Yeah, she handed him a book. Whack. He looked at the book. He said, oh. Said, well, I know you're Hare Krishna. You're trying to do something nice, but the thing is, he said, haven't you got something heavier? So she had in her bag a copy of Dharma, if you're familiar with that book. In the center, there's some pictures. There is a double page spread of a man dying and his relatives are there crying. And sort of behind the bed is like another scene, and like you're looking through into another world. It's the Yamadutas coming from hell. And they look like super heavy metal. You know, heavy metal is something I don't know a lot about. But I heard that some of them are really gross and, you know, dress up and really try their best to come across as being bizarre and hellish. Literally. So, anyway, these Yamadutas, boy, if they had started a rock band, they would have been top of the charts in the heavy metal world. For sure. They were the real thing. Anyway, you can have a look and see yourselves. And so she opened the book and handed it to the one. He looked at this picture. He said, "Wow, that's cool." And he gave her 20 rand. The books were cheap, I think, in those days. And he took the book. Yeah. But someone else, you know, another person, when they were actually distributing the sixth canto, there's another fairly famous story. Another person, I think it was a woman, they only handed him the sixth canto, and they were talking. She was like, "Well, you know, it's not really for me." But then she turned over and saw the back cover, this very picture, the young adutus, and she was like, she froze. And just became silent, like stunned, looking at this picture. And the devotee noticed this, you know, this something has happened now. And he asked her, "Are you all right?" And she said, "I saw these people a few days ago in a dream or something like that." Yeah. And she took the book and became, you know, extremely favorable, and I don't know what happened after that. So, yeah. But some other people, you show them this and they'll think, "Oh, what?" Some other people, you show them a nice picture of the Lord. Some nice, pious Hindu people, and they'll think, "Oh, yes, how nice, very good. I must give the Swami a donation." So Bhakta X Swami gets a sale. And other people, many devotees have complained to me here in Cape Town actually, that these books with Krishna on their cover, that the people see Krishna and they think, "Wait a minute, this is just something different, Indian, or, you know, we're not into these things." And so they want a more secular type of cover, and then they'll take the book. So like this, my point is, when I'm preaching Krishna consciousness, it's a very personal, very sensitive thing. And there's a saying in English, "A man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still." That if you browbeat people and force people and get them to accept, even they may, like, you know, amongst the Christians and Muslims particularly, it seems, they may become practicing people to some degree. But on a deeper level, they haven't accepted. And as a result, they don't change their lives. And this is what is called a nominal whatever. A Christian or Muslim, and there's so many of them. And even they may get up and say, "Oh, I'm a Christian, oh yes." But actually, they're not Christians. They're really not Christians at all. They are materialists. 90-something%. And there's another 5%, or, you know, in most cases, maximum 10, where they've kind of embraced it. And, you know, in their minds they feel they are it, but they are not it at all. They're a long way from it. Yeah. So we don't want that sort of, Prabhupada would say, we want quality. We're not so worried about quantity. Of course, if quantity comes, good. If they're actually quality. But if quantity comes without quality, we don't want it. But if we're getting quality and we're not getting so much quantity, it's not a problem. Even, you know, not to speak of on the broader scale in the congregation, but even in the temples, there were times when there are letters, you can see, if you If you do a search on in Prabhupada's books on the computer for boiling the milk, you'll see there's a number of occasions Prabhupada is replying to some temple authority who is saying that, you know, we've got a lot of devotees in the temple now, but, you know, we're having difficulty getting them to attend the morning program and do this and do service and so on, and they tend to do their own things and talk a lot of prajalpa, and, you know, they're creating a certain kind of less than Krishna conscious atmosphere in the temple. What to do? But still, you know, they're wearing their devotional clothes and tilak. And Prabhupada said, you should boil the milk. Make things like you were reading yesterday about austerity, following the regulative principles. Prabhupada said that. That even though in Kali Yuga we can't do really what the Savalashmas were doing. Of course, they were doing it in order to become good fathers, like get their shakti together to produce lots of good children. But still, the thing is, what were they doing? They were drinking water and they were eating air. They were not eating anything. And this is going on. It's not like for a day, couple of days, a week, something like that. But this is for months or years. And Prabhupada said in the purport, which I assume you read yesterday, that in this Kali Yuga we can't do this, but at least we should follow the regulative principles. At least we have to. And what else do we have to do as an austerity, Prabhupada said in the report? No. He didn't say that. What did he say? There was another thing he specifically mentioned and went into a little detail about it. In Teva, in the Ganges or Yamuna, or if you're not anywhere near them, bathe in the sea. Prabhupada said that. Prabhupada said, this is an austerity. We need some austerity. Without some austerity, we become too soft and, you know, then the material energy can just drag us away. So some austerity has to be there. Yes. So anyway, the thing is, when we're preaching, Prabhupada made the point about this whole subject of how to distribute lots of books somehow. Get the person to take the book. If they took the book, if they've got it, if they gave you the money, you've got the money, they've got the book, that is success. And it ends there. This is what they were thinking. So in order to achieve that end, they have the book, we have the money, full stop. You know, just do whatever it takes to bring the situation to that point. That they have the book and you have their money, and that's the end. It ends there. And unfortunately, at least in that sense, it doesn't end there. But Srila Prabhupada, when he was addressing this whole question, Prabhupada said that if you simply present Krishna, Krishna is so attractive. Krishna is all attractive. There is something in Krishna consciousness, which every single living entity, if they have contact with that, they'll become attracted to Krishna. And it will be the beginning of that process of getting into Krishna consciousness, that initial something which strikes them. And they become attracted. First attraction to Krishna to Krishna consciousness, like the world of Krishna consciousness. So Prabhupada said, you, whatever you say about Krishna, it is not a lie. It is not exaggeration. Even elsewhere, another time, Prabhupada saying the same, making the same point. Prabhupada said, even you exaggerate about how wonderful, beautiful, great, powerful is Krishna. It is not an exaggeration. Your attempt to exaggerate, you have not even expressed a fraction of it. You know, you say, Krishna is so beautiful. He is more beautiful than all the, you know, like Miss Worlds put together. And you might think, wow, that's like some super beautiful person. But it is falling short completely. You know, compared to Krishna, the type of person you are describing who's as beautiful as thousands of Miss Worlds, that person is an ugly duckling. Plain, as they say. Compared to Krishna. So this Prabhupada said, this we have to learn, how to present Krishna. We also have to understand the people. Otherwise you present something to the person, but it's the wrong thing. They're not going to become attracted to it. So you have to consider what is the person, their mentality, and so on and so forth. And then there's some possibility, if you pray to Krishna and try your best, that you may be able to present some part of Krishna consciousness which will catch that individual's imagination, and yes, then some response will come. So Narada Muni, he's expert. He is preaching. It's not, you know, hellfire and brimstone. You are not this body. You know, your father, Daksha, he is not your father. Don't think like a dog, you fool. Of course, if you think like that, you are a fool, actually. This is my father. Oh, yes. You're a fool. But it's not really this type of preaching to present things like that. Joe, why are you going into household life? It is for, well, we won't say that, a certain type of person. Not the type of person you should be. There was in the old days when we had these brahmachari ashrams full of these, what we used to call fired up brahmacharis. You know, whether they were, well, very few of them remained like that. Then, if there was some young brahmachari who was kind of, you know, attracted to the household scene and showing symptoms of that, they had a special, we had a special term. Such a person was called as Brahmachari Grihastha. No, but he was called Brahmastha. Or Brahmastra. If you know what a Brahmastra weapon is. Atomic weapon. You know, in other words, ready to just explode anytime. You know, someone became a Grihastha, was like, he fell down. These were the good old days. Or whatever. Yes, but Narada Muni is preaching. He wants actually to produce that result that they take sannyas, actually, not just the stay brahmacharis, but they specifically renounce once and for all their possibility of household life. And he achieves it, as we'll see. But, like the verse said, kutani, diplomatically. Not diplomatically either in an unpleasant way, but just presenting the reality in very suitable terms is effectively, so they get the actual message, but in a way which inspires them for Krishna consciousness, for Krishna consciousness and for making real progress. And they did that. And as we'll see, Daksha, the father, he was not so happy. As they say, you can't win them all. But they became devotees. And even though Daksha was not so happy, but Narayana then used Daksha's negative reaction also in a positive way. Hare Krishna. Any comment or question?
Yes. Roger, when we distributed books and someone might not be interested in the book, is it so important to leave a very good impression of the book, to still be very friendly and even maybe try to say something nice and converse with them a little bit before you just leave?
Well, you know, we shouldn't. I mean, we should always be friendly and nice. It's not like we have to put on a big act, you know, big smile, artificially, but I mean, we should feel happy, and we should feel happy to interact with them in Krishna consciousness. And even if they don't take a book, then, and we may feel a little disappointed, but at least we can feel happy that perhaps they held the book, they looked at the book, they heard something about Krishna consciousness. You know, like that. We don't need to then, if they're not going to take the book, we don't need to then really spend time with them and go on and on. You can just nicely say, okay, fine, in a friendly and decent way. But I remember back in the 70s, we were distributing books somewhere in England. And this one devotee became a little frustrated, no one would take a book. Someone almost took a book or something, and then he didn't. And the devotee was trying to get him to take a book, but he wouldn't take the book. And then the devotee said, ah, you're just in Maya. As the man walked away, I remember hearing that. And then he thought, why would you bother saying that? And he doesn't understand. And he just gets now a further negative impression. So I don't know what the alternative would be that you're suggesting. Tell them to get out.
Well, I just mean like if they don't think of leaving abruptly, just
send your people. Not abruptly. But we have our service to do, so we don't want to waste time, that's a fact. So if you see they're really not going to take a book, you tried your best, it's reached that point. You know, you've gone as far as you can go within reason. Then just very nicely say, okay, that's fine. Thanks very much. Nice to meet you. And then away you go. Not like, won't take the book, then suddenly you're not there. grab the book out of his hands. You're calm. Any other comment or question?
Roger, what about the technique of collecting money in the name of Food for Life and then going out to people?
Yeah, well, that's something I've talked about a lot over the years, is that there's nothing wrong at all with telling people or showing people like a board with different pictures, showing what we actually do, in fact, and asking people to give money to support that. There's nothing wrong with it. In fact, it is good. It is very good. If the people see some little presentation on what we actually do and give money for that, and whether they take, if they get a book also, then it's better. But even if they don't get a book, they're greatly benefited. But if we just collect it as all just food for life, food for life, food for life, but very little of it goes for that, then Prabhupada specifically addressed that point, that the money collected for food for life should go to for food for life. Food for life includes all prasadam distribution, actually. All. Including what is about to occur here in some minutes. So, you know, it's not necessarily all just for the squatters or the street people. But, and our experience is, you know, with the board, if the board is done in a broader way, including Food for Life, because it is one of the programs which we do, then people don't really give less than if it's just, you know, the big picture of some starving child with a plate of Food for Life. In fact, some people, the idea of feeding vulnerable people, they don't like that. And they won't give for that. They don't like that sort of charity. But if it's broader based, then they will accept it. So those are some thoughts on the subject.
Raj, I would like to put some comments on the point you made. The Prabhupada said boiling the milk. And then yesterday you mentioned the first time where he said Lord Nityananda's mercy is inconceivable.
Right.
So these two can be seen as contradicting each other, but I would like you could elaborate.
Okay. You know, obviously, Srila Prabhupada, well, the point is, in regard to Lord Nityananda being merciful, is we don't want to get into like a militaristic type of mentality or, you know, like a boot them out mentality. If someone really genuinely cannot make it to maintain the minimum standards required for temple residents, but they're devotees, then they should relocate to an environment which is more suitable for them and continue progressing in Krishna consciousness from there. And the mood should not be that, you know, you are, well, just we are kicking you out. Because the end result of that is, in so many cases, that we effectively kick them out of Krishna consciousness, not just out of the four walls or off the property. We actually kick them out of Krishna consciousness. So, you know, it definitely happens. Some people become attracted, genuinely attracted to Krishna consciousness, but for various reasons, you know, it can be different reasons in different cases, it is not suitable for them to live in a temple. You know, sometimes I've seen some people, they have psychological conditions, and they have to take medication. And as a result, they can't follow the morning program much at all, which is one thing. But also sometimes in their interactions, because of the effect of the medication, you know, they can't just think. The busyness and the energy of temple life and so many people living on top of each other, they react sometimes. And you get kind of social situations arising and arguments and all that. Or some people, you know, they may just be married with children already. And there just isn't a place in the temple for them. Literally. And I mean, what to speak of, whether it's suitable for them or for the children. So, you know, there are definitely cases where it's actually better for the people's Krishna consciousness to practice from outside and visit the temple, and they can progress and become good devotees. And we see it. As opposed to booting them out. Yeah, that, you know, like a clearly negative approach. So we should definitely be merciful. And you know, it's only really if people living in the temple are becoming offensive regularly. Then and there's like aparad, there's a pattern of aparad and becoming like real misfits that we would normally so much think of having them live outside. But then again, it wouldn't be a matter of booting them out. And then boiling the milk, yes, well, you know, the thing is that, and our experience is a lot, where you have, there have been at times in certain places big drives to get more people to live in the temple, in different temples around the world. I remember in Bhaktivedanta Manor, massive drive, it was incredible. It went from a temple of like maybe 70 devotees living in to there were at most maybe 400. And, you know, really, there was, you know, the ashram, forget about the ashram, I mean, the living quarters. The temple room at night was full. The prasadam room was full. And you probably don't know Bhaktivedanta Manor, but those of you who've been there, every room on the ground floor was full at night of people sleeping. But then, and of course, you know, they were devotees, and they wanted to be devotees, at least to some degree. They had, you know, agreed to try to become devotees or had some attraction to Krishna consciousness enough, and the devotees were pressing them, and the whole sort of formula came to the point where they were living in the temple and doing devotional service. But then some of them, because they weren't so interested, they would, you know, in their spare time sit around and talk about other things. And then others, who may have been not quite as marginal, but still somewhat marginal, you know, not totally convinced if they should be there yet, living in the temple. And they had the same material interests from before. You know, they would hear them talking about the music. Usually it was, in England it's like that, the music, the parties, the festivals, the social life. And they would get drawn into the conversation. And so you'd have these pockets of new devotees, but actually they were cultivating, along with some Krishna consciousness, their material attachments were being encouraged. Whereas at least those who were less marginal, you know, if they got good association and were not exposed to those material influences, they could have carried on and become good devotees. But then, you know, you'd get them, they would sort of draw people, the really weak ones, would draw others who were not so weak, but they were fairly weak, into the circle, and then they'd all go. You get the idea? So therefore there's a need sometimes to boil the milk. Doesn't mean we're going to now become rigid and hard and You know, if you nod off while chanting japa one time, you are out, because, you know, we don't need people like you. You know what I mean? So it has to be done. It's like the preaching. It's all very personal, scientific, sensitive, like that. Yeah. But, you know, what happened, you know what happened in Christianity is that in order to increase the fold, they lowered the standards. Previously, they also had these standards, strict standards of morality, for example. Don't do this, you can't do that. But then they wanted, you know, people are attached, and they wanted to increase the numbers. But the people would not get involved because it was too much. So they lowered the standards and the numbers increased. And then what happened was the people with the low standards took over, either by military or just democratic means. We've got 100 people, got 110 people in the temple or in the organization. 10 want to be strict and follow the principles. The other 100 want there to be only 3 regulative principles. So if you have a democratic system, the 100 will take over, and that's what happened to Christianity. That is Christianity. The lower standard has become accepted as the normal standard, but it's not the normal standard. And that's why you get so many people that pass as Christians. But if you examine what is Christianity, or particularly from the Krishna conscious point of view, you'll see they're just materialists in the garb or with a sort of veneer of religiosity or spirituality. But it's only skin deep. Is that okay? Hare Krishna. Shri Prabhupada ki.